Will the sentencing of Aung San Suu Kyi discourage dissent or further galvanize the 10-month-old resistance to Myanmar's coup? 2 years under house arrest, the first of several sentences to come against a Nobel Peace Laureate who at 76 may or may not ever walk free again. Before the putsch, critics called her too accommodating to the generals. Now that she's silenced, is Suu Kyi reinstated in her status as the face of Myanmar's pro-democracy movement? Resistance coming in many forms these days, from flash mob protests to tax strikes. Will that pressure from ordinary citizens pay off? What about armed rebellion in an ethnically diverse hinterland? Armed rebellion that seems to be growing. And as for the junta itself, well, can it ride the storm or take the nation even back to the reclusive state it was in during its previous half-century-long stint in power? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking, has Myanmar now reached a point of no return? And joining us from outside Paris, activist Alex Onkant, member of Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Francois.
From Rome, Burmese journalist Tin Le Win is with us. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
He was France's ambassador to Myanmar from 2003 to 2008. Jean-Michel Lacombe, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
David Camroux, honorary senior research fellow at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. How are things?
Pleasure to be back again.
Thank you. The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Yeah, we heard it first as an initial four-year sentence against Aung San Suu Kyi, cut in half. Again, it seems like it's the first of many. Yinko Yatari has the story.
With journalists barred from proceedings, these are the only pictures of Aung San Suu Kyi's trial. Now she's been sentenced, there'll be no reaction from her lawyers, as a gag order means they are not allowed to comment publicly. Aung San Suu Kyi was first handed 4 years in prison, but hours later, her sentence was slashed in half after receiving pardon from the junta chief Ming Aung Lang. Suu Kyi will not spend her two-year sentence in prison, but at an undisclosed location where she's currently being detained. The military government says she's guilty of breaching COVID regulations and incitement against the military, the latter relating to statements from her party condemning a coup d'etat in February. Amnesty International immediately condemned the ruling.
The harsh sentences handed down to Aung San Suu Kyi on these bogus charges are the latest example of the military's determination to eliminate all opposition and suffocate freedoms in Myanmar.
It's the first verdict out of a dozen charges, which also include corruption, violating state secrets, and illegally importing and using walkie-talkies. The combined maximum sentence would be more than a century behind bars. Her supporters say the cases are baseless and designed by the military to end her political career. Aung San Suu Kyi's party won in a landslide in last year's general election, but she was arrested and her government overthrown by the military on the 1st of February. In the following weeks, protests swelled to hundreds of thousands of people. They've been met with a deadly crackdown. Amnesty says the military has killed 1,300 people since February and arrested thousands more. The junta has defended its actions against those it calls terrorists.
By the way, Myanmar's embassy here in Paris, we reached out to them. They have declined our invitation this Monday. We hope they'll join us again in an upcoming show. Alex Onkant, this is the first of many sentences. What's your view on the way it was announced and what lies ahead for Aung San Suu Kyi?
Thank you, Francois. And first of all, I'd like to say that just before today, we had a very disturbing video released online in Yangon of a small protest group. So as you know, there are still protest groups still going at large inside the country. And a military truck crashed into this protest troop, killing about five people on the spot.
We're going to show that video in a moment from Sunday, Alex. And I want to get to the resistance. But first, what about Aung San Suu Kyi herself?
Well, I think, you know, this has shown that the lack of contact with the outside world. She has not been allowed to speak to anybody. Her lawyers have not been allowed to speak to anybody. And so this gag order really puts us at a distance where we have very little information of how she is feeling, what is the situation of her health, and what really went on inside those court cases as well. We have no hearing that is publicly announced. And so this bogus charge, as you said, and this two-year pardon is really just another way for the military to entrench themselves into power.
Tin Lei Win, the fact that they're staggering all the cases, what does that tell you?
Well, I think, you know, soon after the coup, I was on this show and I think David was there as well. And I think we were talking about how the military's intention was just to decimate, you know, the NLD and the presence of Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar's politics, because as long as they exist, there's no way for the military to win elections or hold on to power. And I think this is, you know, one of their tactics to prolong and in a way psychologically, you know, torture both the people of Myanmar and the defendants as well, you know, and in a way to show that they have the power. And I think, you know, like your correspondent said, this is just the first of many verdicts to come. And the anti-corruption charges and the Official Secret Act charges, those are the ones where the maximum sentences can be really, really high, up to 15 years for each case. And, you know, it is not a surprise. I think many people have expected that she will be found guilty and she will be sentenced to jail. But this prolonging in some ways is, like I said, it's a psychological torture that the military is inflicting on its own people and the defendants.
Is it a smart move by the junta, David Cameron, to stagger this out this way? They clearly want her out of the public eye for good. But
they want her out of the public eye, but my question is this counterproductive? Because in a sense, as a symbol that we don't know quite what she thinks. She, in a sense, is more powerful than if she was free. And also it's counterproductive in the sense that now, in what we're now calling the Myanmar Spring, we're in a kind of somewhat revolutionary environment, a new generation has taken partial control of the democratic movement. And so
she's become a symbol. She's no longer an active figure.
She's more of a symbol and less of an active figure. And the fact that there is a government that has been a government in exile, the National Unity Government that's been created, means that, yes, she is more a symbol and less of an active figure. And so keeping her as a symbol, in a sense, for the military is counterproductive.
Jean-Michel Lacombe?
Well, I think the resistant movement now, Aung San Suu Kyi has nothing to do with it. She was under lock and key, right at the very day of the coup. The movement organized itself without the lady, because for abuse reasons. It has a life of its own now.
And is the NLD at the center, her party, is it at the center of that resistance movement or not?
The difference between NLD, the party, the organization, and the lady, because nobody can talk to the lady. I'm familiar with this situation when I was posted there. And then what we have seen is a farce. And you are sentenced to 4 years, maybe two. It's a kind of rustic dialogue with the international community. We are nice. We can talk. We can engage. The Russian and the Chinese will say, and the ASEAN, of course, will say, yes, of course, and don't miss an opportunity. And then the international community, the West, will not be convinced.
The rational reason is they want her not to be able to run for the elections, which they've planned, and one, their word is not really worth a great deal, but they're planned for 2023, so she wouldn't be able to run. The question is, will there also be a banning of the National League for Democracy? It would appear that the Chinese have been putting some pressure on the junta not to ban the NLD, but that's the next thing that we must be careful to watch.
So, Alex Ong Kant, there is a shadow government that's been installed. There's been, as our panelists here are saying, the civilian opposition that's been organizing itself these last 10 months. How central is the NLD to that organization?
In many ways, this government is a creation of the CRPH, and the CRPH is the community representing the parliamentarians, which was legitimately elected in November 10th of 2020. And so this government is claiming its legitimacy from this 2020 elections that all the international observers and parties agreed upon, and which the people voted in and was claimed to be free and fair. In this elections, the NLD did win by a majority rule, and so there is this presence. However, that is up until that creation. In this new government that has been formed, a new sense of unity has been formed between all parties and between all ethnic groups or all activist groups, whatever, and so on and so forth that you will name. The reason being is that the military is now very clearly the only and the only obstacle in the Burma's path towards a free and fair democratic federal country. And so the new understanding between all of these actors is that it is not only just going to be the NLD, and in fact we have seen a very diverse cabinet of ministers that has been formed. We have not just diversity in terms of ethnicity or race, but we also have diversity in gender, and specifically we even have a LGBT human rights minister that was formerly in France just a few weeks ago on a visit. And so the diversity is meant to take it forward in strength. We are all reaching out towards all people, all groups, and the Rohingya specifically has also been taken on board, where we now have an advisor to the government on Rohingya issues, who is a Rohingya himself. And so this kind of centrality around the NLD is been a little bit left behind, not because of any factions or any splitting as such, but rather because we are creating new bonds and becoming allies with everyone else against a common enemy, which is the military.
And meanwhile, as you were saying at the outset, Alex, the protests never went away after last February's coup and the initial big demonstrations we saw. And as you mentioned, on Sunday, there were demonstrators in Yangon that came out for a flash mob ahead of the Aung San Suu Kyi verdict. This footage courtesy of San San. Just minutes later, security forces ramming a car into the crowd. It's disturbing footage. At least five killed, and that's raised the temperature in the country's largest city and throughout Myanmar. This was the sound of citizens after nightfall, banging pots and pans in Yangon and protesting against the coup. Tin Lei Win, your thoughts on how organized the opposition is domestically and abroad?
You know, it's as somebody who grew up in the 1988, you know, during the 1988 protest, which was one of the, I guess, last also major protests. It's been really fascinating to see how organic the protest movement, both inside and outside of the country, has been this time around. Obviously, Myanmar for the past 10 years before the coup was not the same Myanmar as the 1980s. A lot of technological innovations, young people who are getting involved, you know, so much more creativity and so much more solidarity. Like, you know, Alex said himself, the NUG is possibly the most progressive government and cabinet we have seen. There are still, you know, some issues, but it is the best we have seen. When you say, you know, organized, I think it's hard to say that they're organized in the way that you have the hierarchy. I think a lot of the protests have been quite spontaneous and, like I said, quite organic. One thing that has shown over the last 10 months since the military coup, and despite repeated and increasingly violent crackdowns, what it has shown, you know, just the sounds that we've just heard of the pots and pans, is that the protest is not going away. And whether it is, you know, through a formal organization structure or through just ordinary people getting extremely fed up with what's going on. I don't think we're gonna see the opposition weaken anytime soon. We're still going to continue seeing flash protests. We're still going to continue hearing banging of pots and pans, and there will be more, you know, armed attacks in the cities.
Yeah, I was gonna say, how many people among those protesting want to take up arms? What anecdotal evidence do you have on that Tin Lei Win?
So, you know, at one point, right, I think quite soon after the coup, there was a lot of hope among the people in Myanmar. And I'm sure you've seen all these pictures of people when they were protesting, asking the UN and the international community to come and help. They've pretty much given up, and they've decided that the only way change is going to happen is that they are going to take it and do it themselves. So there is a huge, I would say quite a large group of people, you know, even amongst people that I know, friends, former colleagues, relatives, who are peaceful, nonviolent people who now believes there is no other way of trying to rid the junta as it is, as we now have it in Myanmar, you know. And I will be perfectly honest with you, I have qualms when I see, you know, targeted assassinations of informants who are perhaps not part of the military, or, you know, government officers who are trying to get trying to ask for electricity bills and get shot. But I'm very aware that I'm sitting in Europe talking to you safe, and so many people in Myanmar are living under constant fear, and the only way they think that's gonna, you know, that's gonna change is if they take up arms, and it's gonna be very hard to draw back from that.
At what point, Jean-Michel Lacombe, do we call this a civil war?
Well, if it is a show of strength, you have to know who is ready to fight among the ethnic armies. You have two of them which are not ready: the War Army. And
before we talk about the ethnic armies, just when you hear what Tin Lei Win is talking about, people who more and more are taking up arms or are carrying out summary executions of those who collaborate with the junta.
Well, I don't think this is a very good idea, because it may antagonize a lot of people in Burma, in towns. Not outside, but in towns, if you start shooting informers or policemen, you're bound to have people who won't like the idea because they have families and so on. But talking about ethnic armies, we know who is ready to fight.
Or let's call up a map about that. There's old insurgencies that have sprung into action on Myanmar's borders, the borders with Thailand, China and India. So, Ambassador, if we look at this map here, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, let's say, to say roughly, on the right-hand side, you have ethnic armies ready to fight. On the top, you have Waha Army, which is controlled by the Chinese. And you have the Arakan Army, which is another way of saying Rohingya. So the Waha...
That's the part in red there, we see on the left west side border.
And on the top, Waha, it's important because it's a real army. I thought about roughly 20,000 people and artillery.
It's the best armed and best equipped.
The best equipped. So they will do what the Chinese tell them to do. On the other side, you have ethnic armies who
are the Chinese letting them fight? Are they tacitly approving them?
No, they are not ready to fight. They will do what the Chinese tell them to do, and so far they have not been receiving instructions.
And what about on the borders with India and Thailand?
Well, that's another huge problem, because India has restless little states in that area. And they don't want to get involved in a fight or help insurgents because in Manipur, Tripura, Meghalaya, and so all those tiny states belonging to India, China has before started creating problems, and they can do it easily again. So I think now who is going to help the fighters? Thailand before was a back area to rest and recreation for the fighters and so on.
I hear that's changed, though, with COVID, David.
I think they are no longer eager to do that. India, no. It's too dangerous.
On the eastern border with Thailand, that's where the People's Defense Forces, the young volunteers are getting trained amongst the Kachins and the Karen and some of the Shan. But on the border, the western border with India, this is a problem for India, because the Indian reaction to the coup has been the most disappointing. The world's largest democracy has reacted to this coup by basically assenting to it and by not taking a strong stand. And this
why
makes,
is that?
Well, precisely as Ambassador Le Cam was saying, because they have their own ethnic sort of insurgency problems on the border with Myanmar. And there was just a couple of days ago a kind of a problem when the military, the Indian military, killed civilians who they thought were insurgents. However, we now have refugees coming, especially from Chin State. And Chin State on the border with India is a particular target of the military. The Chin have historically been their greatest adversary going back to World War II. They know their terrain very well, but they're the worst armed. They've got homemade rifles. And so they're an easy target for the military. And that's where we've seen villages being burnt down. And really the use of air power to try and destroy the insurgency.
Can the military do it all? Handle an insurgency to the east, to the north, to the west, and basically, according to this map, a little bit to the south, and crack down on civilians in the big cities?
Probably not. They can't do it all. They can certainly repress. It's the only thing they know how to do, and maintain a situation of stalemate. But it's the civil disobedience movement which perhaps is the greatest threat to them, because when people refuse to pay their electricity bills, when the military shows it's incapable of helping the civilian leaders who they are close to them, who are soft targets, then this has become problematic for the military. But we're in a situation of a stalemate, and this is where we'll talk about this perhaps later, this the international community needs to act.
Alex Onkant, your thoughts on all these groups taking up arms taking up arms at the same time. We can show images, by the way, while you're speaking, from the French news agency AFP of the Karenni Nationalities Defense Force, the KNDF, training recruits in Kaya State. This is kind of like propaganda video that we received this Monday. Your thoughts on this, Alex? The fact that, you have all these armed insurgencies now.
Thank you, Francois. Well, first of all, these armed ethnic groups, as we call them, have existed for over 60 years. Myanmar is home to the longest running civil war in history as well. And many of these ethnic groups primarily took up arms since those days against the military, the Burmese military as they saw it. It is because they have been systematically oppressed, and there has been what we call clearing operations over the years. There has also been the Burmese Myanmar military has also never been more ethnically diverse in its leadership, and they have systematically done so many oppressive things. Only now are we banding together because we have seen the shared suffering, and so this taking of arms is not a new thing. That's the first thing to be established. But when we see incidents like this video of people being crushed on the streets by a car, when we've seen videos again of homes being raided, of children as young as 2 to 3 year old being shot, even in the safety of their own homes, and we've seen over 1,200 people that has been killed since February 1st, that boils your blood when you're inside the country. And so a lot of these people that used to believe in peace peaceful protest, and there are, as we've seen, still many who still continue to peacefully protest inside the cities and in many areas every day around the country. And so when this movement is, when peace is not afforded to them, and when protection is not afforded to them, and when we've seen that the military responds with overwhelming violence, that includes, again, not just these horrendous acts, but also the burning of entire villages and so on and so forth, that, you know, gives people a sense of feeling that they have nothing else but to turn to a angry response of fighting.
And on that score, Alex, what contacts, if any, are there between the government in exile and those different rebel movements?
I'll get to that. And which is that, you know, when people have this sense, they turn to other means of defense. And so this is why this has been called a defensive war, that the taking of arms that has, you know, been started over the last 2 months. And so these forces have joined many other of these ethnic armed forces, and they have all grouped into what we now have are three varying types of resistance defense, as we call them. The first would be organized People's Defense Forces, or PDFs, as we call them, that are directly under control of the NUG and that are responsible for different, and they have formed, as we've seen, different conventions of armed response that are supposed to follow, such as the Geneva Convention and so on and so forth. The second type is rather the defense forces that are under the control of the ethnic armed organizations that are still independently operating on their own, and so have, and they're probably the longest operating ones. And the third are more local defense forces that have spurred up locally that are not really connected to everybody.
And are all three of those kinds of militias in contact with the government in exile?
No, only the first that are the more official PDFs are in contact with the government in exile. The others are kind of operating independently or on their own. And also adding to the former discussion around India, I mean, the borders around India, Zagai is also another state, like Chin state, that has seen a heavy repression. But let's not also forget that, you know, just to give you a very concrete fact, in October of 2020, India delivered a submarine to the Myanmar military. And so this military relationship that continues, which we expect to continue to this day, is also very difficult. But that does not cover the relationship. And so a lot of the forces around the border regions are seeing different activities and different new alliances.
Tin Le Win, I'll put the question to you that I put to Ambassador Lacombe. At what point do you call it a civil war?
Well, you know, I'm just going to echo what Alex said. Myanmar has been in civil war for almost 70 years. It's just that the violence is now spilling over into big cities and towns, the kind of places that we've not seen before. And we are finally witnessing the military's brutal tactics, the kind of things that we've heard from, you know, ethnic groups for so long, and the kind of things that the Bama majority previously did not believe. Now they're seeing it with their own eyes. This is what the military is capable of. Myanmar has been in civil war. It's just now we're seeing it in more places.
We're seeing it in more places, and that brings us to what David Cameron was asking about earlier, which is the international reactions. Among those, that of China, which wants to keep channels open with all sides. But if you listen carefully to the daily briefing at the foreign ministry in Beijing, it hardly sounds like the country's ready to openly endorse the junta these days.
As Myanmar's friendly neighbor, we sincerely hope that all parties in Myanmar will proceed with the long-term interests of the country in mind, bridging their differences under the constitutional and legal framework, and continue to advance the hard-earned democratic transition suitable for Myanmar's national conditions.
David Cameron?
No, the Chinese are playing it both ways, and there's also perhaps another foreign policy which is being determined in Yunnan itself, but in you know, there may be things happening in Yunnan which are not controlled from Beijing. Certainly, objectively, the coup was not in the interests of China. They had reached a modus vivendi with Aung San Suu Kyi. Their interests were better protected. In fact, during the period of Aung San Suu Kyi, the military turned to receiving arms from Russia rather than China. So they tried to play it, in a sense, both ways, keeping the Hua, as Ambassador Lacombe said, quiet, because if the Hua joins into the fray, that would become very, very messy indeed. But at the same time, they don't want to ban the NLD. They tried to keep some sort of doors open. They didn't argue for the ambassador, for the change of ambassador at the United Nations. They didn't push on that question. So there are things, they realize there are things beyond their control. But, you know, China is perhaps has the most influence on the military. And certainly what they're trying to do is certainly hasn't progressed. They've relied on ASEAN to find a solution. You know, the ASEAN solution has not worked. The junta has refused to meet the special envoy. The problem is, when you try and isolate a military junta which wants to be isolated and return to the situation that they knew for 30 years up, well, for 40 or 50 years, it doesn't really, it's counterproductive. So in a sense, the isolation of the military is something that perhaps the military, you know, wants. One hopes that there may be some changes within the military, that there may be more moderate officers. This may be an illusion. Some would argue, some people who know the military much better would argue that if Min Aung Hlaing could be replaced by an even harder liner, one hopes that there are some moderate officers like existed at the time of Kim Nguyen and of Ten Sien, but we've not got no, at the top level, we've got no indication that there is any kind of fractures occurring in the junta.
And Jean-Michel Lacombe, you were telling us the last time how trying to figure out what goes on inside the junta, it's harder than Kremlinology.
Now, to close the matter about the army, the regular Myanmar army is an ethnic army. You cannot raise above the rank of captain if you are not a Buddhist. So this army had no qualms on machine gunning down ethnic minorities, but now they have to shoot Bama, that is Buddhist, and it's more difficult. you have, I mean, so far you had no regiment or battalion going on the other side. But you had defection of people.
Yeah, about 3,000 defections, but nobody above the level of captain, I don't think.
Well, captain, if you are Catholic, you cannot raise above the rank of captain in the army. Chinese, the first time that the Chinese were very clear about the problem that the junta is creating is when they had to vote for... when we went, they repressed the Buddhist demonstration in 2009, and China vetoed. But they said that really the junta were making life very difficult for the Chinese diplomacy. And that was very clear at the Security Council.
Tin Lei Win, when you think back to what's happened since February 1st, would you say that... surrounding states have acted according to script?
Yes, in the sense that they've not done anything to stop what's happening in Myanmar, right? I mean, ASEAN has been shockingly disappointing. The international community have not been much better. There have been a lot of rhetoric, but there hasn't been, you know, that much of actual support. And, you know, in that sense, again, Myanmar is being left to its own devices. And that's also why we are seeing the armed conflict. And, you know, I agree completely with David in that the hunter wants isolation. The hunter also wants the rest of the world to forget about Myanmar, think of it as a failed state and just leave it alone so that they can do whatever they want with it. And I think it's very important that the international community does not, you know, let them succeed. I'm at a loss, though, as to come up with the exact strategy. Okay, do we isolate? Do we not isolate? Because in many ways, the hunter is so intransigent and inflexible that, you know, it's hard to see how things can change unless China or Russia do something, or there's mass defections within Myanmar. One last point that I do want to make, though, is that I would really like the international community to see what's happening in Myanmar in a broader context beyond just the politics and the conflicts and the killings, because there is a humanitarian crisis brewing in Myanmar, and a very bad one at that. The most recent article that I wrote about, you know, there are people who are not displaced, who are not affected by conflict, but are facing tremendous difficulties, rising poverty and hunger. And things are going to get worse. Just a few days ago, the UNDP released the first survey post-coup and found that nearly three quarters of the household has reported a drop in income since the coup. And one in 10 respondents said that their household currently do not have any income. So the international community needs to look at it beyond the narrow confines of politics and conflict.
So Alex Onkant, listening to that, you feel that the international community should be pressed to further isolate the country to reach some kind of tipping point. After all, we're talking about a junta that has its fingers in many pies in the economy of the country. Or do you let this play out domestically?
Thank you, Francois. And I think the junta, despite what people might seem about their strength and solidarity, is not as solid as we've seen. We've had several thousands of defections, and there are still many potential defections that have not yet come through. There was a Western commander of the military junta of Western Command that tried to defect, but was not successful, and he was actually caught. But when it comes to the international community, I think there is this oppression that, and when I talk to a lot of these people, they often feel that they are quite already doing a lot in terms of what diplomats do on a day-to-day basis. And that's perhaps sad, because despite what they do, and I agree that in the broader context of what internationally is now available to diplomats, then this might be quite a lot, but it simply is not enough to push the Myanmar military. The tools that we have at our disposal are still very much archaic, very much 80s, if you think of that way. And so the tools that we need to actually topple or to force the military to come to at least some sort of terms is not yet fully explored.
So, what tools exactly? What are you thinking of?
Thank you for asking that. And that's, you know, when you adopt a mindset of, okay, let's do something, then we can come up with endless options. One of the options that has been, speculated around and thrown around is to look at bank accounts that are directly in contact or used by the generals, such as those that are many that we know of that are held in Singapore. Singapore is often the key to the whole situation. And so freezing those bank accounts, looking at those assets, looking at really who are the businessmen, the middlemen that are carrying out those business deals for the military, making sure that, you know, really squeezing down on the finance in a way that is a lot more innovative, a lot more, tighter knit than what broad sanctions would be able to do. And again, you know, we wouldn't go into those conversations, because what we really want is to hurt the military where it is key for them, and not really to hurt the people more, because as we've discussed, the people are not just suffering from a coup that has been particularly violent, but from a global pandemic that they are still reeling on. And so the currency, just for your information as well, has more than doubled. The exchange rate has fallen as twice. And so that kind of impact for a country that is home to over 55 million people is very dangerous. And we've seen several variants, and we don't know the healthcare situation as well. And, you know, knowing in the background that COVID is still rampant, we have no idea of the actual figures and statistics and what we could do to the region. And so ASEAN for sure has a key interest in making sure that stability and peace comes back to Myanmar as soon as possible. But again,
Let me just bring in, because we're running short on time. One last question for Tin Le Win. You heard David Kamrow earlier saying how this is a junta that would be perfectly happy to return to being a reclusive regime. The internet has grown in the decade since they opened up. Is that possible, though? Can you, in a sense, put the genie back in the bottle and return to the Myanmar that was cut off from the rest of the world?
The junta would definitely like to, and I'm hoping that the international community won't let it happen. Definitely the Burmese people, the Myanmar people, whatever you want to call them, will not let it happen. People like myself, people like Alex, you know, people who are outside and can talk will continue to raise the voice. And people like David, you know, helping to bring in that policy and his experience, we need to keep talking. And, you know, France 24, thanks for continuing to report on that. I think, you know, it's really important that the rest of the world continues to work together so that the junta doesn't succeed in putting the genie back in the bottle.
Well, on the 9th and 10th of December, there will be a summit on democracy. Here's a case study that should be on the agenda of that summit for democracy. Let's not have a summit which is about blah, blah, as Greta Thunberg would say. But here's a case where we have a duly elected government that's been overthrown. Let's put that first on the agenda for the summit of democracy. That would be a way forward. And let's recognize the National Unity Government as a legitimate government of Myanmar to level the playing field.
All right, David Kamrow, many thanks for that. I want to thank as well Jean-Michel Lacombe, Alexandre Kant, as well as Tin Le Win. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.